Steve. Steve, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm Steve Jolly, and Steve Bailey, say something so they'll hear your voice.
Hi there, I'm Steve Bailey.
So just call Steve and you'll get the right person. So thank you for inviting us to present today. And this is my first time on this telecon. My understanding is you all have the PDFs that we put together, and so we'll call out the pages as we go through this. Now, the title of today's talk was to talk about how the science really is enabled by the Mars Base Camp proposal. And when I say proposed architecture, I'm referring to what we rolled out at the Human to Mars conference a few months ago, and you can Google and see the fancy video that makes it look really easy that's out there. So, but here, this is more roll up the sleeves and talk about the architecture and the approach that we took. Steve and I were deeply involved with a lot of other Lockheed Martin people, and I know Ben Clark is on, and Ben is our chief scientist and has been involved in this process also. So Steve will, I'm sorry, Ben will jump in wherever I mess up, or I might ask him to make a few comments. So hang on just a second. All right, so let's begin. Let's go to chart two. And this describes the mission and the vision for the Base Camp 28. Obviously, it's kind of bold and we think achievable. We were trying to get humans to Mars earlier than the 2030s, and some of the other discussions are out there. Obviously, NASA asked us to step out of the box a little bit. Now, the vision is a little bit different maybe than some of them are out there, but I think more in alignment with what the scientists and others have probably been saying, which is to try to get the scientists from Earth to in close proximity to Mars to address some of the fundamental science questions that we see raised in the Decadal Survey and the others that are out there. So this is about not sending pilot astronauts that have been trained to do science, but the vision was more of actually being able to train scientists as astronauts and send them. And you'll see with the crew of six that you can have a pretty good complement of these scientists. So this is more like Jack Schmidt and Apollo 17, you know, heading to Mars. Okay, next chart, which is three. And if you probably want to go to four, actually. Hold on, I'm getting mine arranged here. So this is a kind of a stepping stone. So I know Josh Hopkins and others have talked about from Lockheed about how to get there. We've got the EM, the exploration mission series that are in definition, EM-1 and EM-2. EM-1 is pretty much set, I think, in terms of its mission. EM-2 is still undergoing some definition. And then EM-3 through 6, or however many you have to go to on the journey to Mars, according to NASA's Journey to Mars slide, depends on the things that you want to accomplish. What you'll see here is that we tried to start from the other end, starting at Mars and working backwards to determine what the series of steps it would take to get there. And let me add, because we often get asked this question, which is, well, wait a minute, how is this affordable? And one of the things we point out is that between the $4 to $9 billion a year that NASA will spend on exploration missions, and that includes both EM stuff and obviously space station, that over a 10 or 15 or 20 year period, they will have spent $50 to $80 billion on in total expenditures.
Steve, I think you dropped out.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me all right?
I can hear everybody.
Yeah.
I can hear.
Okay. All right, I'll just keep talking. Whoever couldn't hear, hopefully they will be able to. So all I was saying is that we'd laid out from 2028 backwards the series of steps we thought would be necessary. You're going to see that the actual orbital mission that's at Mars consists of many elements, and some of which are hauled out early using the concepts that we've seen others propose of solar electric propulsion missions as kind of cargo trains. The most recent of which I'm aware of is probably the JPL study from about a year ago, but several people have proposed that. So you're not really going to see anything new. What you're seeing is kind of a framework or an architecture around which we think that this can be pulled off, and then I'll be able to explain what science we think can be done with this architecture. Any questions on, I guess it's a little bit interrupted, but the other thing that's shown here, you're asking probably what is that strange wing device in the 2026 timeframe. It's really indicating a new class of atmospheric and science rovers that we are envisioning that that I'll explain in a few minutes. That particular concept is from our Skunk Works team in California of a glider UAV kind of device that could fly through the atmosphere. And others have proposed it. I think I've seen helicopter concepts and others. And we'll explain in a few minutes what is up with that. Okay, next chart, sorry, is chart 5, if I've got them right. And this one is kind of the overview of the mission and how we're going to get there and the kind of orbit we're in. And Steve, I'll let you kind of describe the mission architecture at that level before we go into the science that it enables.
Okay. The idea is to use pre-placement to, in the opportunity just preceding the human launch, to get the laboratory, the assembly node, consumable supplies that are not related to safety. Basically, everything that's not related to safety can be pre emplaced in a one-sol Mars orbit. The idea of the one-sol orbit is to have something that's coplanar with Deimos and Phobos that allows the crew to split up in groups of three and make two separate sortie missions, one to each of the two moons. So by pre-emplacing those things that we can with solar electric propulsion, by the time the crew arrives, the laboratory science equipment, the assembly node, what's awaiting them in Mars orbit is a bunch more power, the laboratory for doing the science work, and that then is assembled into a final configuration that you see in the upper right. That is the Mars Base Camp configuration. There are in this architecture, you'll see it's a mirror image, and that's completely intentional. One of the guiding principles is the idea of self-rescue. So, mission that's upwards of 1,000 days with this kind of remoteness. Have it the ability for the crew to split up, recombine, to jettison pieces of the architecture, to have multiple working at the element level, at the node level, multiple working systems, and to be able to configure those to keep something working. In the end, there are two Orions that return, and in the worst case, the entire crew of six would be inside one capsule. So the idea of self-rescue is architecturally built in and includes the Phobos and Deimos sortie phases. But you can see at the level of conducting the sortie missions that the one Orion with its cryostage separates. It's in a configuration at that point where it doesn't require solar power. And it's going to do a sortie mission where it's effectively living off of a cryo boil-off to run the power system. And that, in that configuration, it goes to first to Deimos and then to Phobos. In those configurations, the crew is split into three and three. Three are waiting back on the base camp. Over that two-week sortie duration, the crew can stay down.
We need somebody to mute. We're getting echo.
The crew can rotate through, but otherwise it's kind of like the Apollo scenario where there are two crew active out on the surface of Phobos or Deimos at any given time. one crew member back in the command module, and they're rotating that out over the course of 2 weeks to do this thorough exploration of Phobos and Deimos.
The other things that I'll talk about in a few minutes are that in the lower Mars orbit or at the Phobos orbit, we're envisioning being able to collect samples, rendezvous, and collect samples that have been vaulted from the Martian surface, either by previous missions or by missions that we bring with us, devices. So we provided, you know, at the top level of now just kind of moving into the science architecture a little bit, and it's all in flux, and so this is a proposal to get the science community talking, is that Steve has provided the capability to have sorties to the two moons. I think we've talked about enough Delta V once we're there to stay for 20 to 30 days to be able to, you know, interact at multiple locations, and we're going to show some concepts, just total concepts of what it might look like to interact with a 1,000th G body, okay, which is not all the pictures that have been published in the past showing people standing upright and with a base in the background and waving and walking around probably are not accurate. And so that came up at the Phobos Deimos conference, I think, a few weeks ago. So that's the basic architecture. And what I'm going to do now is we're going to explain the actual configuration of the vehicle itself. I think on slide 6, Steve has already pointed out.
Steve?
Yes.
I have one question. Is that high Mars orbit an elliptical orbit?
Yes. It's a one solar orbit with a periapsis between 200 and 400 kilometers and apoapsis around 33,000, if I remember right, kilometers.
So you get a long...
Any specific period?
Yeah, one sol, so that it's basically dwells over a longitude so that we can conduct telerobotic operations of sample acquisition and sample transfer from the surface of Mars up to the base camp.
Okay, very good. Thanks.
Okay, going on to slide 6, Steve's already talked about the push-me-pull-you kind of view that the spacecraft has. You'll notice significant electrical power. And if you go on to page 7, we provided a little bit more engineering data, and I'll let Steve explain the basic configuration of the vehicle.
Yeah, so it is a push-me-pull-you configuration. In general, for the big burns, it does take the use of both of the stages to accomplish the entire Delta V, and yes, it's turned around in order to do that. Underneath that tank farm, the basic idea is this is an all cryogenic architecture. We think from a technology perspective, this is all go do. There's no miracles involved here. Either with solar electric propulsion or with in space cryogenic propulsion, there are just some basic engineering to be accomplished to make this a reality. The stage that's attached to Orion, the cryo stage, is very low boil off, but it's essentially fueled and then used. The storage tanks are the zero boil off where is maintained because there's no turbo machinery connected to those because the propellant lines are much smaller and that kind of thing. It's much easier to manage the cryo in a storage configuration than it is in a fueled stage. So we take advantage of that by wrapping those tanks around the crew quarters. So underneath those gold tanks, which you can't see at all very well, is a smaller diameter crew quarters. Wrapping the hydrogen tanks around there drops the galactic cosmic rays when they're full down to about 40% of what it would be without those tanks. So bringing the GCR environment down is an important thing, as radiation shielding for solar particle events For protons, it's very, very effective. It's an excellent storm shelter and reduces for any kind of a solar proton event, they would just simply retreat into the crew quarters. So in that crew quarters are all the essentials for crew survival. The ECLIS systems are in there. The habitat and the laboratory are in effect big empty spaces to a large extent. They're populated with science gear, exercise gear, galleys, and things that are more on the lines of creature comforts. But in the crew quarters, it's where the crew sleeps, where they spend 12 more hours per day, and that's why having some additional protection there is part of what's designed in. There's crew quarters on either end so that in a pinch, the entire crew can be supported by either the left or right-hand side of the configuration. And in a pinch, the crew can return with either the right or left-hand side of the configuration, where nominally they return with both.
Now, what's confusing about this particular view, because we didn't show the sequence of events leading up, is that one of those Lyconic-shaped habitats, which one is a laboratory and one is a habitat, the one that's a laboratory arrived under its own solar electric propulsion tractor before the humans arrive. And so the interplanetary spaceship doesn't involve one of these pieces. It's waiting for you there. But once you're there, then you do a kind of a docking and reconfiguration into this situation, and then the sorties, we'll show some pictures later of how those take place. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the laboratory because that's key to this science discussion. So the laboratory in this current proposition is located in the one sol orbit with the rest of this hardware. It has, we think, probably 40 kilowatts of electric power dedicated to the equipment that would be in there. And the equipment manifest right now is somewhere on the order of 7 to 8 metric tons, I think, is what Steve has worked out. So, and again, those are just early propositions. Ben Clark and some upcoming science workshops are going to help us, based on the science investigations that would be conducted on Phobos, Deimos, and the samples that would be returned from there and from the surface of Mars, would determine what the manifest is, what are the right set of things. It's not intended to replace the curation and analysis facilities that exist on Earth. It's meant to be a field laboratory, better than MSL, okay, and able to handle samples potentially. And this, I will throw this out for later discussion, but if there are samples that people are worried about for back contamination purposes, because we happen to have gathered Mars samples of water or other soil or methane plumes or something that people are worried about, then I have challenged Ben with the idea that we could have a sample handling scheme that would protect the astronauts in that realm. And then decisions could be made about bringing it home and whether you want to sterilize it and all that. So the laboratory is an essential function. And if you go to the next page, we have kind of a diagram that indicates the realm of the potential science here. And in the center of that is the astronaut in the laboratory, obviously a picture from ISS, and we're calling it the Orbital Mars Lab. And what we're showing is the operation of low latency, we call it telepresence, rovers and atmospheric devices and sample return all on the lower half of the slide on Mars itself. The concept from the one sol orbit is that you've got, you know, very low latency, tenths of a second or hundredths of a second latency. And partly what intrigued us in this area was talking with Ben and some of the other scientists there's phenomenon on Mars right now, including the recurring slope lineae and the methane plumes and others that are not well suited potentially for slower robotic missions. And so we're wondering whether these new science craft could actually, under the control of the astronauts, be able to conduct these, I'll call them faster timescale phenomena that we'd like to sample. And so that's really something we're throwing out to the scientists, you know, to imagine that you have this ability. In our minds, you're showing up there with lighter weight entry systems, many of which have been proposed already in literature and talked about, JSC, the Morpheus, and I think that was the right term for it, and some others. And we have some at work at Skunk Works, and others have proposed it, such that you could bring, I don't know, a dozen of these things out, or half a dozen, or maybe more, or they could be international contributions, but they either were towed there or they come in with the main spaceship, and then they can be selectively used. Now, the concept here was you're going to be here, Steve, remind me, it's almost a year in orbit,
yeah,
right?
Just about a year.
So one of the things that we wanted to be able to do was to have the science team essentially conduct their investigations, be able to get data back, some of which is analyzed in the laboratory, some through high bandwidth communication back to the Earth with obvious latency there, and be able to replan the mission, kind of the way field geologists, as I understand it, will change what they're looking at once they're out in the field, and or they come back to their field laboratory, confirm or disconfirm predictions they had made, and then replan. And so when you're a year there, then we want to be able to do that. Steve, I haven't asked him about the ability to return to the laboratory and then go back to Phobos. That it's down in the gravity well, and that may be harder, but we're looking for input about the way that the science investigation should be conducted so that we can, in turn, go back and reconsider the architecture and the Delta V that we're bringing to best enable science.
Yeah, the architecture does provide a good bit of flexibility, and part of self-rescue is to ensure that you have good margins as well. So if you visited Deimos, came back, and then found that you think you maybe should return, you have that flexibility potentially at the expense of some duration or the ability to go to Phobos.
The other thing is that I know there's a lot of interesting controversy about the origins of Phobos and Deimos, but they unquestionably will contain samples of history of Mars since they've been there and wherever they came from. And so it seems that a careful survey of the moons may be required, including the understanding and collecting of samples. And I think somebody mentioned to me the other day that if you get a surface sample, you may just be off Phobos or off Deimos, you're collecting Phobos or the opposite. And in fact, if you want the parent material, you may have to burrow down or scrape away or something, and which leads to the whole issue of what kind of tools and interaction astronauts and robots would have with those moons. So that's really the upper half of this, or the upper right-hand side of this slide, which is the exploration and interaction with the moons themselves and their sample collection. So there's a kind of a holistic approach to this mission. The other thing I would add is that the dozen, say, entry vehicles you might bring with you, or half a dozen, would have global access in this. There is certainly polar regions that would be difficult to probably do teleoperation from this orbit, but there's a large domain of the planet that would be available for deployment. So you're not just, you know, maybe collecting from one area or exploring one area.
Well, I believe this is Ben Clark. So I believe that this orbit can be relatively easily modified to access almost any latitude. It'll take some delta V, but that is something. It's a much less delta V than if you were in the little circular orbit. So it really could explore some virtually anywhere we wanted to, given that capability.
Yeah, good point, Ben. So the I pause for any questions or comments on this general architecture, and then we'll show you some of our concepts for how to interact with the moon.
Steve, this is Dan Lester. I wanted to make a point and then ask a question also. The point is on this slide 8 here, you know, where you've got the where you got the title field geologist up in the right, upper right-hand corner with the astronauts in spacesuits. You know, if you do telepresence right, you're looking at a field geologist in that blue shirt at the upper left. And so don't lose track of that. That is, if your surface surrogate can do the things that you'd want to do, you're actually doing field geology, real-time field geology, sitting there up there in that station. That's just a small point. And the other thing I think I see peeking over from the next slide, what I don't see in your pictures of the vehicle, I don't see Phobos and Deimos. And it occurs to me that really what we're talking about here is a Mars orbit mission that I think you're about to tell us that actually sends humans to Phobos and Deimos. But Phobos and Deimos are not enabling parts of this mission. Because, you know, some concepts like this actually have basing on Phobos and Deimos, where you land on Phobos and base on Deimos, and then you hide under rocks there and you do everything from there. But you're not talking about that. That's very interesting.
Yeah, and we do have kind of an icon of the two moons in that upper right-hand side of page 8. But you're exactly right. We started with concepts that said, hey, let's tether ourselves to the surface and, you know, make it be like you're actually on a base camp somewhere, which would be great if it was like a sixth of a G or a tenth of a G or something. And we quickly decided, well, no, this mission is more than that, and it's bigger than that, and we couldn't think of a distinct advantage for, you know, being that close to Deimos all the time, for instance. And Phobos is so far down in the gravity well that it would just take more effort to get down to it. But I agree, and on your previous comment about robots versus humans, yeah, we are not proposing to know that total answer and do not preclude the fact that you could do this robotically. What I've been told in personal conversations with Ellen Stofan, for example, is that she kind of likes, you know, they imagine themselves with their field hammer going around the surface. We're going to show some few pictures in a few moments about the challenges of trying to do that. But we agree, I think, with the general comment.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's what I was saying. If you do it right, then telepresence can help you. But I respect that opinion. Go ahead.
Jim Head at Brown University.
Yes, sir.
Just a quick comment on it. This is really great stuff. Okay, so I am a field geologist, and I think, you know, my first job was in Apollo and astronaut training and mission operations. And I think the key here is that it's a human robotic partnership, and you need to optimize. So Mike Gernhardt last week gave a great presentation at the Phobos Deimos meeting on, you know, optimizing and utilizing these capabilities to feed forward to Mars as well. So Phobos and Deimos, the way you've lined it up here is really great, because there's so many fundamental scientific questions that can be addressed with this approach that will absolutely give us insight into the two bodies, their origin perhaps from Mars materials that comes up from the surface of Mars just by impact ejecta, et cetera. So I just really underline, this is great. This is really great stuff. And we have all kinds of scientific background about the questions which we can help to forward to you as well. Thanks.
Thank you. Let me move.
Hi. Sorry, one more question. This is Sam Black from OMB.
Hi, Sam.
If I'm reading your chart correctly, it looks like for the transit to Mars, you plan on launching into LEO, assembling there, and then transiting from there into the high Mars orbit. Is that correct?
That's right.
How many launches do you anticipate it would take to assemble the craft in LEO?
So if you follow the full arc from EM1, and now I'm including EM1, I'm including all the SLS launches, it's the full arc is 14. So we're just trying to check our numbers here. So that includes EM1, EM2. That includes the stepping stone stuff. That includes
a big shakedown mission.
A shakedown mission in space first. The next step habitat as one of those points along the way.
If you go to chart 18, I'll let Steve try to if that helps answer the question any.
So, you know, I'll compare that with space station construction, which was, I believe, 29 shuttle launches, 10 or so cargo resupplies at this point in counting, some other proton launches, et cetera, that, you know, that this is very comparable to the pace and scope of the ISS.
I think we did, when we were looking through the cadence of the 2020, we don't have these in here, so we're shooting, you know, without having the data, but there were a couple of years as you approached the actual going that we had two launches per year and maybe had to go to three. Right?
There was a couple of years that were three launches.
Yeah.
But we're working on a new version of
that. Anyhow, we should come out with a supplemental that talks more about that. But we did play all those numbers off and parametrically as we looked at these different options. There was also the opportunity to launch to a C3 of zero and go on from there. Clearly, if you're using the SEP, I think you're going to win out by launching to low Earth orbit and then spiraling your way out if you have the time. But there's a whole trade space here that still needs to be discussed within the industry, you know, of what the right way to do it is. But I think Steve's chart does show a low Earth orbit.
So just, you know, some raw numbers just for contrast. The ISS, as it orbits over our head, is 400 metric tons of dry mass. This spacecraft is about 120 metric tons of dry mass, 300 more metric tons of propellant. So from a dry mass standpoint, it's substantially smaller than a space station. From the standpoint of the number of launches to get it fully assembled, it's significantly lower. So overall, we think that this is the, you know, we're trying to basically say NASA has built SLS. SLS is about to become operational. Orion is about to become operational. What do we do with these vehicles? How do we best utilize those to get the highest bang for the buck for Mars science? And I think it's important to say, before we send people to the surface of Mars, we owe it to that crew, to ourselves, to understand if there's life on the planet and if there's anything that's toxic to humans. So this mission will do those two very fundamental things. I'll find out if life is extant or whether it's elusive or somewhere or perhaps established not at all. If we had a mission that directly sent people to the surface of Mars, we'd have to do it to places where we least expected life to be. For this mission, we can send those robotic vehicles that are operated by telepresence to the places where it's most likely to find life, those places that, if it was Earth, we'd fully expect to find life in where there's flowing water on the surface, where there's at the margins of permafrost, those kinds of regions.
But I have to say that we there's an overlap of the human surface exploration and this orbital mission, but we were trying to propose a mission that can stand on its own science merits without saying that you have to have this before you go to the surface. You can all draw your own inferences, but I think that the science alone is very compelling, and being able to learn more about the globe of Mars entirely. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about is the laboratory. When in this mission in 2028, when the humans return, the laboratory and the copulus stay there, and they're waiting there for the next mission. So, in fact, though we're not showing it today, we envision a series of missions using the same architecture, and the next one or the one right after that goes to the surface. So we're not ready to talk about that today, but we wanted to make sure that the community listening realizes this wasn't a one-off concept. It was intended to provide logistics architecture to get you there, to bring large things to Mars, to do serious science at Mars, and to leave assets there that can be reused. And so much more could be said in that. But let me move on a little bit. We're at 40 minutes, almost 40 minutes past the hour. And if you look at chart 9, it's really just a recapitulation of what we already said. So go to chart 10, and this is a wonderful view that Steve did for us that shows the sortie leaving and going off, and this is where we really get into some interesting concepts. And you say, what is that? What is that? All those little things poking out of the system. And so if you go to, let me see, Steve, where's the next one? Probably chart 13 would be the best to go to. I'll let Steve describe this Marvel comic Superman thing that he's put together. But it helps you understand the physics of actually interacting with a moon. So
yeah, so, you know, we have Orion. It was designed as a from a consumable standpoint as a sortie vehicle, but from a overall concept as a deep space, long duration command and control vehicle. So we're leveraging that sortie capability here. When it's attached to to something where it doesn't have to use its own consumables, it can operate continuously for thousands of days. Where you put it in a position of you're taking the crew and all of your consumables with you, and you start the clock on consumables consumption, that's where it becomes a 21-day-ish vehicle, depending on the number of crew and the way you outfit it, 21 days to a month. So we're leveraging that to add to the docking hatch a excursion module, and on that excursion module, that serves as also a airlock, so that the crew can get into pressure suits, EVA, into position. Then they have these kind of souped-up Superman maneuvering units that are equipped with spider walker extensions. And so let's go to the next, and I'll try to explain how that works. But with this, they're basically
chart 14.
Now autonomous, self-flying astronaut scientists who can pick the places they want to go and move freely across the surface, either in a dive buddy kind of method of operation or going off in different directions. Because the gravity is so low, one 2,500th of Earth, we know very little about the surface. We know that there's lots of fine material on surface. It looks very soft. Lots of the craters are filled in. That could imply that it's as bad as talcum powder to a depth of, you know, meters. So that could be the case, or it could be that it's more consolidated. At this point, we simply don't know. But so what we thought we would do for a system like this, that as a flying flyaway mass has still a total mass of about 600 kilograms, that exerts less than half a pound of pressure on the surface if you were to concentrate it. So
let's go to slide 15.
Yeah. So on slide 15. One of the key ideas for mobility on the surface, you really can't react against the surface except maybe in a basically straight up and down kind of way. To kick the surface would dislodge material and put it into orbit, potentially to escape velocity. It takes very little energy, very little velocity. Even as an old guy, I could jump off of the surface of Deimos if I got after it. So it takes not much of a nudge to get airborne where you'd be. It would take minutes to come back. Even a very small jump off of Deimos, it would be a 20-minute round-trip flight time to get back to the surface. So the idea is to keep all thrusters, even coal gas thrusters, have supersonic exhaust, and that supersonic exhaust would be very disruptive to the surface. So the concept is to point all thrusters away from the surface or parallel to the surface, and to all the reaction force that's against the surface is done with the spider walker extension.
So in this picture, Steve, we can't see the rocket engines. Is that right? Are they on the...
They're on the manned maneuvering unit. They're in. They're
so we should imagine they're pointed at zenith. They're pointing up. Is that right?
Yeah, in the MMU, they're really pointed all over in every direction, but we'd inhibit the firing of the ones that are pointed towards the surface at any given time. So with a rig like this, you get stability, and you're able to position yourself so that you can interact with the surface. And if you go to the next slide,
so we're on slide 16.
That with a combination of motor articulation and leg articulation, that you can get up close and personal to the surface without having to bend over, kick, react, try to maintain your balance, which would be impossible. It would just be a slow motion ballet of falling that would take a ridiculously long amount of time for you to actually finally fall. This system has all the aspects of GNC that provide stability and control and is tuned for this environment so that the crew, when they want to react against the surface, the attitude control system will continue to keep them pushed down, pressed into the surface so they don't go flying away. And as they want to move laterally, you can do so by stepping your spider walker forward ever so slowly. Or if you wanted to get someplace in a hurry, you would have a jumping spider. It would just push you off of the surface, and then you'd thrust laterally to go ballistically to your next location, where you'd then begin a fall into the surface where you would be caught by the legs when you get to the surface.
So what's interesting in this concept is Dan was asking a question earlier about just telerobotic, would be if this were not a human vehicle but were a telerobotic vehicle, it may have these same attributes to be able to grab samples or do something. But I think that the debate in the science community and whatever really should center on what kind of tools and would the astronaut have in this particular situation and actually looking at the surface or being able to distinguish between rocks and their types and or the soil or whatever. What's the advantage of having the human there versus doing a telerobotic? I don't have an opinion. I'm just saying that this is an elaborate system. It's not like just going EVA and holding on to a handrail and doing something because there are no handrails, or at least we didn't envision any in this architecture. But I think that's would be a very interesting topic for conferences to consider and for the scientists to consider.
Yeah, so very much. And whether the legs of this walker should be part of the manipulation system, whether there should be probing or drilling or using of gas jets to blow off the surface or excavate or tunnel, those are all really good questions. And can you get enough field geologist stuff into a configuration like this to is this the right configuration at all? I think it's a very valid question. What we wanted to do is not say, here's how to do it. Here's an idea. Let's discuss.
Yeah, we wanted to provoke the imagination of the team and also to get, the hardcore science investigations kind of beat out a little bit so that we can determine if this is the right tool to do that or whether done robotically is right. But this gives an idea of the difficulty or the degree to which someone has to focus on how to interact with the surface. And so we must dispense with all of our previous beautiful artwork that shows people walking around on the surface. We've been wrestling with this on the Goddard CyrusRex mission. It does involve humans, obviously, at Bennu, but it does involve concerns about how to grab the sample from the surface and the difficulty of approaching an object like this.
The uncertainty of what we're interacting and reacting.
So we felt taking the Orion stack all the way to the ground, or whatever it is, whatever pressurized system you have, bringing it all the way to the surface may not be a real smart idea, but it's all a risk trade.
One aspect of this architecture is just as it can operate assets on the surface of Mars with low latency, could actually do this this exploration of Phobos or Deimos with telepresence. So it gives you an option of whether it'll depend on the priority that those moons have at the time that this goes on, but gives you the option to do it either way and doesn't affect the architecture overall.
And you have to be at Phobos, for instance, to do this, right? Because if you're at the one...
Well, what I'm saying, though, is you could send a vehicle to go to Phobos instead of a crewed vehicle, just send a robotic vehicle and still operate it from the one sol orbit.
Yeah, I was trying to imagine, Ben, that the Phobos is spinning down really fast below us. What is its orbit period, an hour or two?
Not that short, but what you're just worried about it being occulted from the spacecraft?
Yeah.
Yeah, you would have periods of outage, but you'd have long periods where you have real-time contact.
So we have the option to either go in a sortie and be there, you know, in the Phobos orbit where we don't have that problem, or do it from the one sol orbit.
Right.
Yeah, I think it would be certainly prudent. Like I said, we know very little about the surface properties of these moons. They are ancient bodies, though, and could have accumulated a lot of very fine material that could be quite deep. So it would be prudent, I think, to have a prospecting kind of mission that was a precursor that would establish what the surface properties are that could help really narrow down and optimize the design, including the role of humans and robots.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And that precursor could establish physical properties, whether there's hazards interacting with that loose material, which there certainly could be. And then also the uniformity or variability from a geomorphological and a geochemical standpoint. It's really quite analogous to what we'll be doing on the Mars surface.
That's right.
And with any luck, the Japanese will be sending a Phobos exploration and sample return mission in the not-too-distant future.
Right.
Yeah, Jim, thank you very much for your earlier comments and for this also. And it's just the kind of thing that we were hoping to encourage people of your stature and other people that have thought for a long time on how to explore these unusual locations to give us some ideas and guidance here.
Yeah, let's definitely get in touch. We did a graduate course in Phobos and Deimos as part of our survey activity, and the students put together kind of like a flowchart about are Phobos and Deimos in a critical path of surface exploration of Mars. So they've struggled with a lot of these things. So I'll send you some of that stuff, and hopefully you can share it with the group. Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Harley, by the way. Actually, do you mind sending to Dan and to me the material that you have just done?
Absolutely, no problem.
And of course, we have ways of getting in touch with you. I'm also playing moderator. Got about 7.5 minutes left. You can run a little bit late. Usually don't try to. So I suggest we continue moving on.
Well, the rest of the presentation was for context for everybody. And if you go to 17, it just talks about the major elements and kind of making a case for the fact that there's not a lot of rocket science here. I think the part that I would say requires a lot of focus of the team is down there under the robotics section, which is this, and that's really where we need the innovation focused. The things we were just talking about now with how the astronauts would interact with the surface or how robots would, and then the Martian surface and the Martian atmosphere, there's some significant, I think, development there. I don't know if I'd classify it as new technology, but certainly new systems or new architectural methods of getting down there. And I think we're all aware that technology is on a huge uptick right now, and in the nanotechnology area and the miniaturization of scientific instruments and then subsystems, engineering subsystems, is all taking place right now as we speak. And so we should expect, you know, breakthroughs even in the next few years that we could actually accelerate if we were aiming for something like this. So we we wanted to refocus the national and international attention on the things that would enable science in this kind of mission architecture, and then exploit the things that, that we as taxpayers have already paid for, which is the SLS and the Orion. So, you know, that's just full disclosure. That was where we began this architecture. And so we really wanted to draw the attention to these other elements. And I think Ben is going to try to help us with the scientists in some of their upcoming conferences to have workshops, and we want to find other ways to open up the discussion. I might add in kind of my closing thought here is that it, although this shows up with the Lockheed Martin star and we put it out there as a movie, we really intend for it to become a program of record that's NASA's in the countries or it's international. It's not about us. And I know we've worked with our Boeing and Orbital ATK and other counterparts to all kind of breathe into this. So we want to get everybody's fingerprints on it and to get what is an agreed upon architecture, not something where we come up and we say, well, we found it, Eureka, here it is. So this is meant to
be. Yeah, I think there's two really important aspects of this architecture. One is that because the laboratory is an astronaut-friendly environment, meaning it's shirt sleeve, that means a lot of laboratory equipment that's been developed on Earth, which keeps getting smaller and smaller, by the way, as technology advances, a lot of that equipment can be outfitted into such a lab with a minimal amount of re-engineering. Whereas every time we engineer something for a rover, it has to have a tremendous amount of work done to make it compatible with all the unusual environments it has to go through. So this on-orbit laboratory can be quite sophisticated at a reasonable cost. The other thing about this architecture that I think is perhaps even the most important thing is that it begins the exploration of Mars by astronauts without having to have established a base on the surface, without having to have actually proven yet the ability to do human size scale landings and return to orbit. Both of which of those problems are very challenging, and there are some concepts that have been worked on at our area, but there's many ways to do that. But this would kickstart the whole human exploration of Mars at an affordable price.
And moreover, and Harley, moreover, it is more attractive, more engaging than, say, some of the most simple lean Mars orbital missions that have sometimes been proposed as a precursor. This has got real activity of a variety of kinds.
Right.
So I think that's really the end of our presentation. There was a few slides all the way to the end and some websites you can go to, but that is more for general public outreach. We really enjoyed the opportunity to be able to speak to experts in this field and to get your thoughts on this, and hopefully everybody will begin running with it and have national and international conversations.
Sounds excellent. So thank you again. We have time for questions, for additional questions. So folks have questions. This is the time to ask questions and comments.
Yeah, this is Dallas Beinhoff at Boeing. I'm curious as to the thermal environment for the tunnel that goes through the storage tanks. Did you really look at that?
Oh, did we do a detailed thermal analysis of how?
Not even a detail, but did you consider the issues? I mean,
yeah,
this seems to me to be problematic.
Well, yeah. So in order to get cryo to be zero boil-off, that requires some really supremely good insulation, starting with standoffs and working all the way through that. We've been working on storable cryo for quite a while. So to the first order, the environment inside and outside that ring of tanks is not substantially
I think Dallas may need how to get the heat out of it. Is that what you mean, Dallas?
It's more the impact on the crew tunnel itself. You know, it'll be inside a cold environment.
Well,
so you got to keep the crew warm, right?
Yeah, but the tanks, what Steve is telling you is they're like 72 layers of MLI, and they have to get down to such a low heat leak to be feasible. which has been demonstrated by
Marshall. Well, Dallas's point is still valid, even no matter how much MLI you put around. But the other thing, Dallas, is that we have to design against deep space anyway. And so we're really radiating to 4 degrees Kelvin when we're not looking at the sun.
Right.
So that's kind of is a area that we know how to do. I'm not sure how practical this is going to be, because there's those aspects you're raising and probably some other things that are kind of tricky about people living inside a propellant.
Right, right, yeah. We worked on those things as well, and it's good to hear your voice, Ben. It's been a while.
Same here, Dallas.
Yeah, well, these concepts of wrapping the tank, the crew inside there, have been prominent in our, not that they've been solved, but they've been prominent in the literature since the 90-day study, and so we've often drawn the same pictures. But I think that hopefully, Dallas, it's an engineering challenge, and it's not in the too hard bag, but that's why we want to get everybody, with their speak out there so we can think about it.
Yeah, I think that's the right category of the challenge.
Steve, this is Max Fagan at NASA Ames. I just have a question about the vehicle layout. You mentioned that each Orion and propulsion stack pushed half of that vehicle to Mars. Is Orion designed to push that much spacecraft around with a really high thrust stage behind it? Because that's almost 100 tons hanging off the nose there. Is Orion designed to take that kind of load with a high thrust stage behind it?
Yeah, not through the docking tunnel, but through the through the crew module adapter is where the loads from the launch abort system are transferred, and those loads are far, far higher than the thrust loads we'd have from these engines, which are in the tens of thousands of pounds range versus the upwards of a million pounds of
the launch abort is like a 200,000 pound. You're talking about launch abort loads?
No. I'm just saying that what it looks like here is that we're taking these loads through the docking hatch. We're not doing that.
Not true. Yeah.
There's a structural ring you can't see that transfers loads into that crew module adapter. That's the ring just above the service module.
Does that answer your question, Max?
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Okay, again, other questions, folks? All right, great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Steve, to all the other folks. Excellent questions, excellent presentation. And talk to you next week at next Wednesday's FISO Telecom.
All right, thank you very much for listening to us.